So I think many of you were here on Christmas Eve. If you weren't, one of the things that we reflected on in hearing again the story of God's arrival into our midst as the baby Jesus was how, as people were waiting and hoping for the arrival of God, that once Jesus actually arrived, they weren't able to just stay put. Mary and Joseph have to move just to be able to go and have baby Jesus. The shepherds get called out from the fields to come and meet Jesus. The three magi, or however many magi actually in the scriptures, we don't know, but we think of them as the three magi, all have to come and leave where they are to meet this amazing person they don't even know who yet, promised even in the stars that they're studying. No one gets to stay put. Jesus' arrival means that we all move out in some way to respond and participate in the new life that God offers. So what do we do next when we are presented with that type of Savior? God in our lives in that way. As I've been reflecting on that and looking ahead again to this marking of 400 years of the legacy of the pilgrims and our roots as Congregationalists, I've been thinking a lot about that movement, how we can connect to the idea of being a pilgrim. One of the things that sprang to my mind was some of the great speeches in literature and plays and movies that often inspire people to move in some way. I don't think I've shared this before. I'm a little bit of a Shakespeare nerd. I actually especially really like looking at how the plays of Shakespeare are translated into film and the adaptation things that people do. I think, Brian, you said you like Shakespeare a lot too, so maybe we'll appreciate that. One of my favorite plays is Henry V, and that has some of the greatest kind of inspiring movement speeches in all of literature. Many of you may have heard the phrase, "Once more into the breach, dear friends, once more." Starts a speech where Henry is trying to get his soldiers to go and help capture a castle. They say, "Once more into the breach, dear friends, once more, or close up these walls with our English dead," and goes on. Even later in the play, as they're getting ready for one of the most famous battles in all of English history at Agincourt in France, there's a more famous speech because the battle was happening on St. Crispin's Day, and so the speech is called the St. Crispin's Day speech. This is how he ends it, to send his men into battle. "This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day until the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that shed his blood with me will be my brother, be he ne'er so vile. This day shall gentle his condition, and gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day." These words that are meant to drive people in the midst of suffering and difficulty into a greater purpose. On maybe a little bit more of the lighter side, one of the scenes that has been most copied and parodied in all of movie history is from Harry and the Hendersons. Has anyone seen that? About a family that meets Bigfoot, and they become close with Bigfoot. But then at the end, they have to send Bigfoot back into the woods because it's too dangerous. And the father, played by John Lithgow, comes in, and Bigfoot doesn't want to leave, and so he says, "Get out of here! Don't you know we don't need you anymore? We don't want you anymore. We don't love you." He even slaps Bigfoot across the face, because that's the only way to make him leave and be protected. But you've probably seen versions of that same thing in many other things. Again, with the idea, this classic way of saying, you can't just stay here. This may be painful for both of us, but somehow I have to send you on. Some of these famous things are interesting to me because they're both effective in the context of the story. England wins the battle in Agincourt against stacked odds. Harry goes back into the woods and is safe. But there are also elements of things that are a little bit misleading or questionable. How sad that Harry would have apparently rejection in a broken relationship be the thing that sent him off. And wonder how that actually turned out after the bond that they had. How many times do we know, not in all battles, but in many battles, where powerful people, for a little bit of land, a little bit of money, a little bit of pride, send people who will not share in any of that, even if they win, to kill and die, so that they can get that, and use words to make them feel like that's their obligation and duty. And both of our scriptures today see people leaving, going on journeys for different reasons. Some of them themselves may seem a little bit strange. But they do both have links again to how we transition out of Christmas. We heard the lineage of Jesus captured in Matthew on Christmas Eve, where Rahab is listed as Jesus' great, 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 however many greats, grandmother. This Gentile from Jericho, the city that Israel would capture. Probably a prostitute, or at least maybe someone who hosted a house that would sometimes have prostitutes working there, trying to get by as she saw calamity coming. Jesus being potentially stoned by his friends and neighbors as he began to proclaim God's kingdom. This is the first open declaration of Jesus in ministry. We celebrate Christmas with his birth. This is the passage that we see where Jesus is beginning to actually go out and work in the world as God's representative. Going out is meaningful, but it's also fraught. And we know that's true for our Congregationalist forebears as well. We can remember the struggles that they had in England that sent them to Holland, and then from Holland to the New World. We know the struggles that they had when they got to North America, and the struggles that they imparted on those around them sometimes. So as Christians and Congregationalists, I think it's important for us to think about this identity as pilgrims, as sojourners, as travelers, as people moving, and wrestle with all of the things that that means, even when it's complicated, as we form our identities as God's people, as we participate in the life of new creation that God offers. And so that's what we'll be doing in our upcoming sermon, looking at all the angles that we can, thinking about what we connect to, what we can learn from, what we might even say we might do differently. Rahab is a really interesting person, as I mentioned, because she was from Jericho. She probably had kind of an interesting social status in Jericho. It seemed like people knew who she was. She could have easily given up the Israelite spies who, as they were scouting out the land that God had promised them. We're going to see how difficult of a city would Jericho be to conquer. She apparently had the ear of the people who were powerful there. She could have turned them over very easily, but decided not to. And so she's asking to become a pilgrim of some kind with the spies, who themselves are also their own kind of pilgrims, traveling as God's people out of slavery in Egypt, coming to a new place, and then even specifically coming from their encampment to the city of Jericho. But as pilgrims, both of them, we might question some of their motivations, some of their execution. Is Rahab maybe taking a little bit too much of advantage? She sees that Israel maybe is on the rise, Jericho is maybe doomed, so how can she make sure that she and the people closest to her are protected no matter what happens to other people? She doesn't ask to become an Israelite. She doesn't say she wants to give up all of her other local gods and have a very theologically classical declaration of faith in Yahweh. But we see as maybe a journeyer that she's taking baby steps. The spies themselves are clearly focused on conquering. Is it possible that they're maybe even missing some of God's larger movement in the promised land? If Rahab could become a grandmother of God on earth, her family could be included. Could there have been other people that were also caught up in God's community? Throughout the Bible, we see this tension between should Israel destroy or stay completely separate so that they're not corrupted by things that are unjust and not right in the societies around them? But also, do they step too far sometimes and not include people in God's purposes that they were called to? And God repeatedly asks them to weigh both sides. But it is true that ultimately Rahab became fully a part of Israel. They could have said, yeah, we'll take you away from Jericho and not kill you, but you'll be a slave. Or you can just go out in the desert and figure things out for yourself again. But ultimately, God moved to have Rahab and Israel, apparent enemies, come together and find a new fit together. Again, even to the point of this being a grandmother of God. In the passage in Luke, as Jesus begins his ministry, what happened right before this that were the gracious words that everyone was amazed by was Jesus reading in the synagogue the words of Isaiah the prophet about a year of Jubilee where prisoners would be freed, the blind would have sight. And Jesus summed this up after closing the reading by saying, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your presence," claiming that that would be the ministry that he would be doing for the rest of his life. And the people of Nazareth would have had some conflicted feelings about Jesus claiming this type of ministry, because it's basically saying, I'm going to be a messianic figure. I'm going to be a figure that changes the world around you and brings God more fully into your midst. Not 20, 25 years before this, a town as close to Nazareth as Westerville is to us was razed to the ground because of a messianic uprising by the Romans. It was so catastrophic for the area that 30 years later, when another messianic uprising happened in AD 66, which ultimately redestroyed the temple, cast out most of the Jews in Palestine again, helped actually spread some of the early Christian church. The people in that region did not participate in the uprising because they remembered and were so feared of what had happened to them 60 years beforehand. And so we hear that they say that they were amazed at Jesus' gracious words, but then they also say, isn't this Joseph's son? And so it's not clear from the scripture. Is Jesus poking at them? When I read it at first, I said, If they were amazed at Jesus' words and they said, isn't this Joseph's son? Maybe they're really supportive and excited. And then Jesus says, but you won't accept me. Think about all the people before who were like me, but who didn't help their hometown. That's what it's going to be like between me and you. And you're like, Jesus, why are you instigating things with people around you? Why are you making things more difficult? But it's also possible that isn't this Joseph's son was like a smear. Joseph was a lowly carpenter. The people may not have expected that Jesus would be able to have that authority. They might have basically been saying, you shouldn't be saying any of this, plus you're going to get us in trouble with all the Romans anyway. And so Jesus is actually saying, when I start doing all these healings that the Isaiah passage talks about, when I set people free, when I bring the year of God's favor, and you're worried about all of that, you think that some people aren't good enough to be a part of that, you think that the opposition is too great, that we shouldn't even try for that, but when you see it happening, you're going to feel like you missed out. It's equally possible that Jesus is just describing the natural result of when you get caught up in a vision that's bigger than just what's most immediately around you, what will only benefit you or the people absolutely closest to you. But you know that there's something that catches you up in something bigger than yourself, that connects you with more people, that sees more benefit than just what you profit from. But that even as exciting as it is, often has a cost. And sometimes the people closest want to have all of the benefit because they think that that's the way things are supposed to work. That larger vision should have stayed as close as possible and not have been shared, because then maybe you get less than if you would have, if they would have just stayed as close as possible. I don't know for sure which one is really correct, but I do think that it's true that Jesus had a sense that this thing that God is offering is supposed to continue to magnify and have ripple effects and take us out to connect with more people. It can't just be that I get attention for being God's messenger. It can't just be that the people closest to me get some benefit from God's presence amongst them and other people do not. And it might be hard for us to go on the journey. It might be hard for us to think if we would have gotten more if we didn't share some with someone else. But that's what God is inviting me to do. And even if it causes conflict with us, I have to follow that vision. So there are many things that start us out on new journeys. They don't all have to be perfect. Sometimes they're not even profound. We don't fully understand them. Something that comes to mind for me about this, kind of the weirdness that can happen, it's very simple. When Cohen, my son, was between 2 and 3, he had one particular type of shoe made by Oshkosh B'gosh that he got obsessed with. And he would only wear that shoe, no other shoes. So he went through like 5 different sizes of this shoe as he went along. Even had to order it online at one point because we couldn't find it in stores anymore, because he just would not connect with any other shoe. He'd throw giant tantrums if we tried to put anything else on. Wendy would try to do it even under his breakfast high chair seat tray table so that he couldn't see what was happening, and he somehow still knew with his magical toe nerves or something that they were the wrong shoes, and he'd freak out. And then he was getting too big, and so it was just a children's shoe. They didn't make any bigger sizes, and he was not going to fit in them anymore. We were panicking about what is going to happen. We would take him to other stores and say, you can pick out any shoe that you want here. We'd go and say, we're going to have family shoe picking out time, and so Mom and Dad and Aislinn and you will all pick out shoes. You can pick out the shoes that we're going to wear, and then you can pick out the shoes, anything that we could do to just make him have to progress through this change while we were worried. Nothing worked. Every single time we tried, another giant tantrum. And then one night, while my mom and dad, his grandma and grandpa, were over, we weren't even talking about it, had kind of let it go, getting close to bedtime, and he says, I want to go get new shoes. No idea what sparked this, but we're like, we are taking advantage of it no matter what, right now. We all hop in the car, drive over to the store, and let him go pick out what he wants, and we're all excited for him and give him lots of support. And then it wasn't a thing anymore. He's been able to have whatever shoes from that going forward. And it's weird, right? It's simple. It's a little kid's kind of fixation. But we can hear, you know, Cohen had this thing that he couldn't let go of. We had this thing that we wanted to be in control of and determine it had to turn out a certain way. And whatever it was that sparked this change, we both had to let go of something to take up something new. And doing so changed all this tension that was happening around us. And so now he had these new shoes to go on his new little journeys together. See, in the end, we know that lots of things send us out. Again, none of them have to be perfect. They don't have to be profound. We don't even have to fully understand them. This was true of our pilgrim forebears as well. I've been researching them for this series to kind of have some connections. And one of the things I found that was interesting is that they didn't go straight to the New World from England when they were being persecuted. They went to Holland. They weren't being persecuted there. Things were basically fine. It was a little bit harder to get by. They didn't always connect with their neighbors. They wondered if their kids would have the same values that they wanted them to. even as they grew up with people around them with slightly different values and culture. And as they wrote about why then they wanted to leave Holland and go to the New World, that was the thing. Nothing as profound as being arrested or killed for their faith, but just we think that there's a little bit more economic opportunity. There won't be as many influences on our kids that we're worried about. Those are very relatable things for all of us. Sometimes I think maybe the stories of the pilgrims feel distant because we don't have the same cultural place as what we normally associate most with them. But there are things that we can really connect to. And the funny thing is, also, to be honest, the very things that they were worried about in Holland, that they said, this is why we need to go to the New World, not 5 or 10 years later, there's tons of writings by the leaders that they're still worried about those exact same things. Their kids still are questioning the values that they're trying to pass along, even though there's less other influences. Sometimes it's still hard to get by, or the people that are being more successful are leaving the community so that they can go off farther away and get bigger farms. And so the influence of more money is actually making it harder on their community too. The journey didn't solve the problem, but it was still important for them to try to find something bigger than themselves to be caught up in. Because the thing about being a pilgrim too is that traveling is that our starting spots don't have to be set because that would waste the journey anyway. How many of us would go on a journey and say that we don't want the journey itself to have any impact on us? We want to have everything figured out completely before we even start. We'll know exactly what we'll experience and how we'll feel and how everything will go before we even do it. That's not what a real journey is about. And when God travels with us, that's the perfect time for us to be shaped and transformed and grow and develop. The biggest thing, I think, as we find ourselves on pilgrims again, is we learn from the separatists that became our Congregationalist fathers and mothers, as we learn from stories like Rahab and Jesus today and the other stories that we'll look at throughout the next upcoming months, again, is what's that vision that God is showing us that catches us up in something bigger than ourselves, that we have to be more than just staying put with the same things around us to be able to fully participate in? It's got to be more than just what only impacts us or only what's wrong with the world. What's transcendent and life-giving and makes us connect to things that are more than just what we're used to seeing? And can we also find value in the process of going after that vision? Not only thinking it doesn't mean anything until the vision actually happens, but as we fully realize it, as we participate in it, as we go towards it, do we see that God is working as well? Because no matter what mindset we start from, we'll probably all start from different ones. We might even look back partway on the journey and say, I wish I hadn't started that way, but I'm glad I've gotten this far and now I see things differently. All of that is something that we can value. That's why we journey as pilgrims. We're going to find our fit in the larger vision, like Rahab found her fit. Like Jesus knew that he couldn't just fit in what he knew, but he had to find a fit and connection with all of Capernaum, all of Israel, all of Judea, and even those people who were not Jews that were in the land that he would meet. Have any of you ever gone on a vacation before and someone that you know has been there as well? And they'll tell you all the things that they did. With it almost seems like the presumption that, like, if you go here, if you don't do exactly what I just told you is the best way to go to this place, then you are not doing a good journey. Or someone who has visited somewhere for a short time and then they talk to people who, like, lived there for years as if they're the real experts about that place. And so they know everything about what's really important or all the cool things, and the people that live there don't really get it the same way that they do. Right? The way that we miss the journey is if we try to have it be more about us and try to control everything about it instead of being caught up in that larger vision that comes from God. We can't stay put and deny the vision. We can't try to be the ones who are fully in control of it as if it's really ours and not God's. And that it being beyond us is what calls us into something that's more important. Shared experience, having those conversations together, even with people who have sometimes obnoxiously gone on a vacation somewhere else, is good. Having advice is good. Having our co-journeyers is good and important. That's part of what God wants for us as well. But we also want to be able to have our own experience and not just hear somebody else's. We want to be able to hear other people's experience and learn from that, especially when it's a little bit different than ours. And then hopefully our perspectives mean something to each other that gives more value to the journey and gives us more of a picture of the vision that's ultimately God's, and we're just trying to get pieces of and trying to get those pieces to fit together. God's vision has all this combination of both established paths, how we can chart exploratory, complementary courses, and ultimately be pilgrims and journeyers together. That's what the Spirit will be trying to learn about in upcoming months and capture together as a community, standing on our pilgrim foundation this year. And so as we figure out how to take those steps to continue in the service today, and I invite us to think about how we can present ourselves as journeyers and our resources to God and our tithes and offerings. But I hope that you'll all talk to me too about the journeys that you've already had, how we can learn from each other about them, and what journey that you see before us that God is giving us a vision to be caught up in.